Welcome back to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. The city of Tal Afar in northwestern Iraq is the latest to fall to a militant group. This comes after the Sunni Islamist militants posted chilling pictures of the purported execution of hundreds of captive Shiite members of Iraq's security forces. Those claims have not been verified. But the group ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, warns of more killing to come. As concerns mount about the militants' march toward Baghdad, both U.S. and Iran officials are hinting about working together to deal with the crisis. For more about this, Tim Shorn, assistant professor of political science at the University of South Dakota, joins us. He's also director of the International Studies Program at USD. He teaches Middle Eastern politics and is a regular guest on Dakota Midday. He's with us here in the studio. And Tim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, let's talk about this group, ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Who and what is this?
Well, they are one of the many kind of new offshoots of al-Qaeda, and they are grounded in the war in Iraq going back to shortly after the United States invaded in 2003. They are rooted in the Sunni community in Iraq, there are just a lot of factors that we see coming together in Iraq right now. ISIS is made up of those who were maybe tossed out of government upon our invasion. They may be working with former Ba'athist officials, former members of the Iraq military, but all of them coming from the Sunni Muslim community. And when the United States invaded, it gave groups like al-Qaeda an opportunity to turn the Iraq theater into part of a larger chessboard, if you will, of very militant extremist Sunnis to take on their far enemy, i.e. the United States, in just one more area.
Now, Iraq, the dominant population is the Shia.
Correct. And this takes us back to some of the issues that arose when the United Kingdom, our good friend Great Britain, created what is now modern Iraq in the aftermath of World War I. As one person put it, they put together three peoples and two oil wells and called it Iraq. They joined together the Sunnis, the Shiites, and the Kurds, and the oil fields in northern and southern what is now Iraq, and created one country. And almost immediately, the British began favoring the smaller Sunni population, much to the concern of the larger Shiite population. And that is something that continued. And so the Shiites always felt rather marginalized. Saddam Hussein was certainly no friend of the Shiites. And so the Sunnis just began to think that they had a real right to govern Iraq. And that all ended when we overthrew Saddam Hussein and the majority took control. The problem is that when the Shiites took control in Iraq, that while they were very big on the notion of majority government, they weren't big on minority rights. And we have seen the Shiites under al-Maliki not being a particularly open and pluralistic form of government. And so it, again, opened the door for Sunni extremists to take note of that, to take advantage of that, to import foreign fighters, to rally extremist Muslims within Iraq, and to join together under ISIS.
And how much of this problem was created by the al-Maliki and just essentially kicking out the Sunnis from the government?
Oh, that's an interesting question, and I don't know if you or many of the listeners had the opportunity to read the New Yorker article about a month and a half ago by Dexter Filkins, but he went to Baghdad and interviewed those who had been involved in the process of kind of raising al-Maliki up to the leadership position. And al-Maliki has always been a bit of an enemy of the Sunni population, certainly of the Saddam Hussein government. He had been to some extent supported, if not trained, by the Iranian government. And when al-Maliki came to power, he saw absolutely no reason to share power with the Sunnis. His attitude was the Sunnis were our oppressors. The Sunnis would, if given the opportunity, oppress us again. We are going to ensure that that doesn't happen. And he embarked on a program to essentially, if not disenfranchise the Sunnis, certainly marginalize them, and certainly to prevent them from gaining any form of power and influence.
Now, the cities in Iraq, including Mosul, seem to have fallen rather quickly. Is this something of a surprise, and why has it been seemingly so quickly that this has happened?
I'm not sure how big of a surprise it is, but it does raise a real question that the Iraqi army is not a particularly well-run army, perhaps not particularly well-trained, perhaps not particularly committed to the notion of Iraqi army. Initially, as a lot of people will remember, when the United States went in, one of the things that occurred was that the existing Iraqi army was essentially disbanded. We then had to embark on a program to rebuild an Iraqi army. And as the Shiites ascended to power, they saw this new Iraqi army as a way to protect their influence, to protect their new status. And so it didn't so much become an Iraqi army as a Shiite army. And it was also not particularly a well-trained army, and not necessarily a politically well-supported army, that a good deal of the power within Iraq, the military power, resided with militias on whatever divide, whether it was the Shiites or the Sunnis. And so the people who were manning the points over the last week or two were not necessarily that dedicated to the notion of an Iraqi army. Whereas on the other side, you had Sunni extremists who were absolutely committed to enlarging their self-proclaimed Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. They were absolutely committed to this holy war and this political war. And along with extremists from within Iraq, they have probably recruited extremists from outside of Iraq. They are working with forces inside Syria. And there's a real concern that ISIS has designs on parts of Lebanon and even perhaps parts of Jordan.
So what is the ultimate goal of ISIS? They want to... Because it's what, as you mentioned, not only Iraq, but
right.
Jordan and Syria.
Their ultimate goal is to create an Islamic state, a very radical Islamic state of Sunni Muslims, and to create, to some extent, kind of a crescent of radical Sunnism that would begin in parts of Lebanon, go through parts of Syria, down into Iraq, and perhaps even encompassing parts of Jordan then.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're talking with Tim Shorn, Middle Eastern expert here at the University of South Dakota, talking about the latest events that are happening in Iraq. I'm wondering if maybe Prime Minister al-Maliki might regret his not coming to an agreement with the U.S. and keeping at least some troops in the country?
And that's interesting, because I think he was really waiting for the U.S. to get out, for that would give him the opportunity to consolidate power in Iraq without anyone attempting to referee the political conflicts. So to some extent, he got exactly what he wanted. The problem is, and I'm not sure how strategic of a thinker he is, I'm not sure he was sure of what the end game would be. He has done something rather remarkable, though. He has now joined his forces, at least to some extent, together with the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr, a group that he had earlier tried to remove from the political scene in Iraq. And al-Sadr is a Shiite cleric. He comes from a long line of Shiite clerics within his family. And then he also has managed to, in some ironic, perverse way, to get the United States and Iran on the same side. So while we'll have the U.S. and Iran working together to some extent in Iraq, we will still see the U.S. and Iran on opposite sides for the time being in Syria. So the notion of politics making strange bedfellows is here in spades in the Middle East right now.
Another interesting aspect of that is that this allows Iran to then have more influence, more power in not only Iraq but in this region. Again, we're talking Iran, which is a Shiite-dominated country.
Right, and that's been one of the probably ultimate ironies and kind of the law of unintended consequences going back to 2003, is that when we removed Saddam Hussein from power, when we eliminated the Ba'ath Party as a political actor, when we disbanded the Iraqi army, what we essentially did was undermined the Sunni power structure. Well, nature abhors a vacuum, and so does politics. And so the Shiites, as a majority, look to step in and fill that vacuum. Well, who's the leading supporter of Shiites in the region? Iran. And that, I mean, it didn't necessarily make Iran the chess master in the region, but it certainly helped to open the path for them to exercise more influence within the region. And that has not been lost on a number of other countries, including Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries, Israel. So, yeah, this is a process that we're going to have to watch, because at some point we're going to see that occasionally Iranian and American interests come together.
What does this mean, do you think, for ongoing relations between Iran and the U.S., particularly regarding some of the nuclear issues?
Well, it looks like, at least from the outside, from some of the reports we're getting, is that the nuclear negotiations are moving ahead relatively well. And I saw a report even this morning that it's possible that some of the sanctions that are in place against Iran will be allowed to expire in 2016. And if the United States and Iran can continue to move the negotiation process forward on the nuclear weapons, if in fact we're forced to work together on the issue of Iraq, then it may open some opportunities. One of the things that we need to keep in mind about Iran is that it is not a unitary actor. There are a number of forces present in the Iranian system and the Iranian government. And at any one time, you can't be sure who it is who is calling the shots. And they're not always necessarily on the same page. You'll have the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and the Revolutionary Guard, and members of the Ministries of Intelligence and Security on one side. On the other side, you'll have President Rouhani and some of the more moderate forces. And you can never be sure that both of those sides in Iran are talking to each other. They're certainly not always acting together. And so it's going to be interesting through this process to see who gains the upper hand, if they're able to work together, or if ultimately one side will be attempting to undermine the other.
Going beyond Iraq and Iran, what does this mean for Syria and Assad?
That's another $64,000 question. We have many of those. And it looks like, at least right now, Assad is gaining the upper hand. And he has reclaimed some of the towns that had fallen to the rebels earlier. The question becomes, does international attention get moved away from Syria? I mean, not just the United States, but the Europeans and others oftentimes have difficulty watching more than one ball at a time. And as we start juggling things like Iran, like Iraq, like Syria, like Ukraine, and now as we watch what's going on in parts of Africa with the attacks this morning in Kenya, are we going to be able to keep all of those balls in the air? Are we going to be able to manage all the different things that are going to be going on? And I think that Assad is probably hoping that while attention is focused on Iraq, that perhaps he can continue to move forward and people be paying a little less attention to the types of actions that he will be taking. The problem is that for the rebels against the Assad regime, the Iraqi fight may very well draw some of their supporters away and weaken them as well. So it's going to be a process through the course of the summer to see where a number of these conflicts and processes go.
What can the U.S. do in dealing with the situation in Iraq?
Very little. Mm-hmm. We may take steps, whether it's through air power or sea-based power, to attempt to limit the movement forward by ISIS. But there is really very little that we can do. We are not able to influence every single event. We are not able to preordain every outcome. And I think that's something that we all need to remember, the last outcome that we preordained was the removal of Saddam Hussein. And from that point on, everything else became a little bit less predictable, and we failed to consider the numbers of different actors that would be involved, the different interests that would compete, and whether or not we were willing to or able to perform some of the tasks that would be necessary to keep Iraq together. I am reminded, when we go back just about 10 years, there were many people, certainly by 2006, 2007, who wondered if it was even possible or desirable to keep Iraq together. And then Senator Biden had co-written an op-ed that called into question the ability of Iraq as it then existed to continue to exist. And he wasn't calling for the dismantling, but clearly a different type of power-sharing agreement would be necessary. And certainly I was wondering as soon as 2005, 2006, whether or not Iraq, as it had been created by the British, was a state whose time had come to an end.
Still don't know the answer to that.
That's right. And I think to some extent we do know part of the answer, and the answer is that Iraq is – as it existed up until 2003, is no longer going to exist. The Kurds are simply not going to return to the fold. In fact, they're using this opportunity to consolidate their control over Kurdish areas and areas that they wanted. So at least Iraq as we knew it is probably long gone.
Finally, what do you think for the American soldiers, military personnel who served during the Iraq War? What do you think? I don't know if you can step in the mind of a soldier. I know you're in the National Guard, but I wonder if you step in the mind of what might be going through their heads as they see what's happening.
Well, I'm sure they're wondering, did we leave something incomplete? Did military or political leaders kind of misrepresent the fight? I'm sure there are going to be a lot of questions about, was there something that should have been done or could have been done? I think certainly at the individual soldier level, they all did everything that they could possibly do, and even moving up the levels. And ultimately, the questions are of a political and to some extent a strategic nature that is way above the individual. And it does also raise questions about what can we expect and hope to accomplish with military force, especially military force alone, without taking into consideration, you know, political efforts, diplomatic efforts, humanitarian efforts, et cetera.
Well, Tim, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and talking with us on Dakota Midday again.
My pleasure.